we've heard from Bianca, we're supposed to essentially solve quantum gravity using the renormalization group this week. Fortunately for me, all I have to do is give an overview talk on one approach, which uses renormalization group at its core. So I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating week, and I'm very pleased to be giving the opening talk, not the least, because then I can sit down and enjoy myself. My task is to give you an overview of asymptotic safety. And by now, asymptotic safety is an absolutely huge subject. There are very many publications. And so necessarily, this is going to be a little bit of a partial view, but I hope to cover pretty well all the foundational aspects to this asymptotic safety approach. Okay, well, we know experimentally at the largest scales that general relativity seems to work very well. And so that tells us that the correct description at these scales is in terms of a metric field. On the other hand, we know at small scales that quantum mechanics works very well. And somehow these two things must be consistent with each other. And that tells you, unless there are violations of quantum field theory, even on the largest scales, that the correct description is in terms of an effective quantum field theory, at least for many decades of intermediate scales. So that leads us almost immediately into the Wilsonian renormalization group language. And in terms of that language, the famous problem that gravity is not perturbatively renormalizable is this statement here, that if you try to build gravity as a quantum field theory about the Gaussian fixed point, then you'll find that Newton's constants are an irrelevant coupling, which means that the universality of this description is rather limited. And so that naturally raises the question, what is the correct UV completion of this picture? And you basically have two broad brush choices. Either the correct UV completion is a quantum field theory, or it isn't. And I'm going to take the view, along with the asymptotic theory, asymptotic safety community, that the correct UV completion is a quantum field theory. Moreover, that the correct variables to use continue to be the metric. In which case, what you need is to replace this Gaussian fixed point by a non-perturbative fixed point. It's worth emphasizing that even if that conjecture is incorrect and the UV completion is some non-field theory, as we will hear many examples later, nevertheless, this description as an effective quantum field theory, it seems sure, is valid on very many length scales, and so is part of the understanding of these of quantizing gravity. Well, to my knowledge, the first example of a non-perturbative UV fixed point being conjectured in order to save theorists some embarrassment is for the Higgs, actually in Wilson and Kogut's original review article on the Wilsonian renormalization group. So they were addressing the problem that four-dimensional scalar field theory has no interacting continuum limit if you base it around the Gaussian fixed point, the so-called triviality problem, which is to a large extent irrelevant these days experimentally now that we know the Higgs mass is 126 GeV and the standard model can survive up to the Planck mass as an effective quantum field theory. But anyway, they conjectured that maybe the Higgs had a non-perturbative continuum limit based around some other fixed point. Well, these non-perturbative fixed points are rare, but they're not unknown. This is an example, again, due to Wilson. If you take the four Fermi model in less than four dimensions and consider its large n limits, even though this thing is perturbatively not renormalizable, i.e. does not have a continuum limit around the Gaussian fixed point, you can build a non-perturbative fixed point using large n techniques. Well, famously, it was Weinberg who conjectured that maybe gravity saves itself in this way, too, and showed that that was true in 2 plus epsilon dimensions, along with many other authors. And Weinberg dubbed this asymptotic safety. And it's also been shown to hold in a formal large n limit by these authors. So that, again, in a sense, is in a perturbative scheme. Well, how do you go beyond that? you need a non-perturbative tool. And analytically, what's used almost exclusively is the exactly normalization group, so-called by Wilson in his original review. So the exact renormalization group is a realization of the Wilsonian renormalization group in the continuum. And it's the most popular version is this version of this flow, is this flow equation shown here. So what we have here is an infrared cutoff Legendre effective action written for some fields, where the cutoff is imposed by adding a mass term. But this is a momentum-dependent mass term, so it switches on when momenta are less than some scale k. So this scale k will play the role of the renormalization group scale. But in fact, what's going on here is that because you have this infrared cutoff put in by hand, you're essentially just doing the partition function. You're doing the integral of the partition function down to some scale k, and then stopping, and then using this exact flow equation to complete the functional integral by lowering the scale k down to zero eventually. So what we have here is a flow for this cutoff Legendre effective action, so it depends upon k implicitly. And then on the right-hand side, you see you've got a differentiated infrared cutoff and then an inverse two-point vertex, which has been regularized by this infrared cutoff. And then this space-time trace. I'll go over these details more later. So this equation has some nice properties. In particular, as I've already mentioned, if this scale k tends to zero, you get back the full Legendre effective action. You've done the functional integral. On the other hand, if you find a solution here which exists for all scales k, in particular, exists for k tends to infinity, then automatically your quantum field theory also exists on all scales k, and so you found a continuum limit. In other words, you've built a quantum field theory that exists without a cutoff. Well, that has to be significantly adapted to do quantum gravity, and we will come back to the details later. But what I want to do is just give you a flavor of some results. So the first brave person to do this was Martin Reuter in this paper. And it's generated a huge literature, as I've already mentioned. So just in the background here are the papers being written since November. This is a selection of some of the reviews. So what you can do is you can, and this is why that flow equation is so useful, you can take the effective action, and if you had an exact solution, it would be an expansion in every possible operator you could possibly write down, local operator. It would have an infinite series of local operators. But you can make an approximation where you just throw away some operators. So that's a model approximation. And the most drastic approximation you could do and still keep some information is just to keep the unit operator corresponding to the cosmological constant here and Newton's constant corresponding to the Ricci curvature term here. So that's what Martin Reuter did in that paper. If you then crank the handle, just throwing away any terms that don't fit this template, then what you pull out from that are a couple of beta functions. And they're written here in perhaps one of the simpler forms using a sharp cutoff following this paper. So what we have here is beta functions, coupled beta functions for the cosmological constant and Newton's constant. I should have said, since we're doing the renormalization group, we're going to write everything in terms of dimensionless variables. So I'm using the scale k to make Newton's constant dimensionless, the cosmological constant dimensionless, and then I'm going to introduce so-called renormalization group time, which is just log k over some fixed physical energy scale.
In the first line, you have G phase and lambda
phase. Yes, you're right. It should probably be G phase and lambda phase. So here's the beta functions. And it's worth remarking that you've got some singularities here. Notice that you get some singularities at lambda equals a half. Well, if you plot those beta functions, if you plot the flows coming from those beta functions, what you get is a famous plot that looks like this. So there are many similar plots. So for various truncations, but this is one relating to the one I was just shown. So here's the Gaussian fixed point, and around which gravity is not perturbatively renormalizable. But you see you have a non-perturbative fixed point up here. And you can have flows that come out of this non-perturbative fixed point, come down close to the Gaussian fixed point, where the Newton's constant and the scaled Newton's constant and scaled cosmological constant will pick up effective dimensions related to these fixed point here, so they're classical scaling dimensions. And then you can shoot out along here, along positive cosmological constant, which corresponds to what we experimentally measure. So this trajectory here could be us, could be the real universe. So a couple of other features that are worth mentioning. There's this, typically with these truncations, you see this spiraling effect that corresponds to the fact that the scaling dimensions of these operators are typically complex. It doesn't always happen, but it often happens with truncations, and it's likely to be a truncation artifact. And then another thing that I would want to notice is the fact that these trajectories here stop at lambda equals a half, scaled cosmological constant equals a half. That's related exactly to what I was showing you earlier, the divergence in the in those beta functions. So to my mind, that problem was solved in Cadello, Pacacci, and Remedi's paper here, where they showed that if you choose a different cutoff function, you can avoid this singularity, and these flows go all the way to k equals zero, as they should, in order to complete the partition function. Well, there's been since then a huge amount of work doing very many different truncations, and this graph is taken from these guys' review. This is the one I was just discussing with just a Ricci scalar and a unit operator, but many other powers of Ricci scalar have been added. There's been additions of Weyl curvature terms, higher derivative terms more generally. Matter has been included, various more complicated things to do with ghosts, which I haven't yet even talked about, have been included. And always you see the same pattern, you see this asymptotically, say, fixed point. And what comes out of this pattern is that this asymptotically safe fixed point, providing you've got enough operators here, has three relevant directions. So that amounts to saying that if you build quantum gravity about this fixed point, you'll have three couplings, which you can roughly speaking think of as Newton's constant, the cosmological constant, and these order R squared terms. Okay, well, in terms of powers of Ricci curvature, these authors took this at furthest. So they've considered polynomial truncations of that flow equation up to power r to the 35 in terms of the Ricci scalar. And this graph is taken from their paper. And what's shown here is along the top are the level of the truncation, so how many r to the integer powers you're keeping up to r to the 35. And then down along the bottom here is shown the real part of the scaling dimensions of the operator spectrum that you find, the eigenoperator spectrum that you find. So here are the three relevant eigenoperators I was just talking about. And then you get a whole tower of irrelevant operators. And what you see is that as you increase the level of the truncation, from these dots, and as they sort of gradually settle down here, what you see is a lot of regularity and a convergence in terms of the dimensions of these irrelevant operators. But because we're doing a polynomial expansion, we're in a sense assuming from the beginning that these curvatures terms are small. And so it's as one of the points of this talk, that it's necessary to go beyond these polynomial truncations in order to explore order one scaled curvature terms. So how do you do that? And in fact, how were those calculations actually performed that I've already shown you? Well, I'll get into some of the details now. So the first step is to take the metric and split it into a background metric plus a fluctuation. So the partition function can be written as an integral over the fluctuation fields instead of the full metric. And because that's just a shift, just a change of variables in this partition function, intuitively, you should expect these results to be background independent. But there's a lot of technology that needs to be thrown in first before you get there. So here again is the split of the metric into its background plus fluctuation part. Remember, we have to introduce an infrared cutoff, so we're going to do that measuring scales using the background Laplacian. And then it's very typical to impose the Landau gauge, since following from these authors, you can see that you don't at least have to worry about the running of the gauge parameter then. But because we've imposed a gauge, the expression of diffeomorphism invariance at the quantum level, which is the BRS, the expression of diffeomorphism invariance at the quantum level will become BRS invariance. So we have a BRS invariance for the fluctuation field. But those ghosts are massless propagating fields, so we need to introduce an infrared cutoff for those too. And that then breaks the BRS invariance. But if you're careful, you can retrieve it in the limit in which you've completed the functional integral, in which you take this infrared cutoff to zero and get rid of it. Then we've got to invert that two-point function you saw inside the flow equation. And a very useful technique there is to do a transverse traceless decomposition like this. And instead of using the fluctuation field, use these pieces instead. Well, there's a Jacobian for that. So you get auxiliary fields and their propagating fields. And so they need an infrared cutoff. And this is all of this was already in Martin's original paper. So what about these infrared cutoffs? Well, there's some neat tricks that you can play with the infrared cutoff. So typically people use this optimized cutoff profile that was introduced by Daniel Littim. And you see that it has the Laplacian plus the cutoff scale times a theta function, Heaviside theta function of the same thing. When that's plugged into this equation, this differential here effectively restricts this space-time trace to terms in which the eigenvalue of the background Laplacian is less than this cutoff scale k. When that happens, what you get is, whoops, that's not supposed to happen. No, that's better. What you get is that inside this two-point function, effectively, you've got minus the background Laplacian squared, that background Laplacian, that's coming from the kinetic terms, plus this optimized cutoff. This theta function is just one, and so this guy cancels this guy, and all you're left with is the k squared piece. So this inverse two-point function just becomes k squared, which makes it easy to compute. Well, that trick doesn't quite work because life is more complicated. We've done this transverse traceless decomposition. Let me pick on one such term, which is this unphysical scalar contribution here. If you compute its two-point vertex, at least on a constant curvature background, this is what you get. And we want to basically replace these background Laplacians by the square of the effective cutoff. How can we do that? Well, the trick you play is that you adapt to your infrared cutoff. So you take the infrared cutoff to be what you want with the background Laplacian and plus this optimized cutoff in place, minus what you started with, which is this guy here. So that when you add these two together, you get the optimized cutoff where you want it in front of these Laplacian terms. And due to the fact that the cutoff appears differentiated in the flow equation, and the theta function, therefore, is 1, what you find is that this collapses just down to this simple formula here. Well, in scaled terms, notice that this is actually 1 minus r bar over 3, and we need to take this inverse, so that's going to give us a pole in 1 minus r bar over 3, and I'm going to come back to that. Okay, so I've talked about how you expand this thing out and introduce ghosts and auxiliary fields, and how you introduce the cutoff. How do you do the space-time trace? Well, that's a little easier to see if I write that more explicitly. This is really the integral over space-time of a kernel evaluating coincident space-time points. And a very typical technique for doing that is the heat kernel expansion. Well, this is a short distance small curvature expansion, and their coefficients are independent of the choice of background metric. So that's nice. You see background independence occurring directly by using this trick. And furthermore, this theta function that appears in the optimized cutoff formally truncates this, this heat kernel expansion to a finite number of terms. So for example, if you're working on a background which is just a four sphere corresponding to a positive scalar curvature, constant scalar curvature, the terms you get out of the heat kernel expansion are just coefficients which are polynomial in the scalar curvature. Except that this is not really the whole truth. The asymptotic expansion, the heat kernel expansion is an asymptotic expansion. And the true result that you get from doing the space-time trace on a four-sphere, for example, is really a staircase function. As you can see, by rewriting this trace in terms of the eigenmodes of the background Laplacian. So then you have a sum over all eigenvalues less than this scale k. And as this scale k rises, for example, you will gradually, every now and then, you will pick up a new eigenvalue, and this will change by a discrete amount, giving you this staircase function, which is illustrated on this graph taken from these authors. So Benedetti and Caravelli emphasized this fact that, mentioned this fact that indeed the heat kernel expansion is not the exact answer. And these guys then took this much further. And so they explored within a conformally reduced gravity in three dimensions the issues that follow from this. So here's the staircase function you would get on a three-dimensional sphere. And they showed, for example, that the terms that are being picked up here, which are neglected by the asymptotic heat kernel expansion, are terms corresponding to propagating round and round the sphere many times. They also explored this on three-dimensional hyperbolic space, and I will come back to this paper later. So what happened to the idea that this was supposed to be background independent? Well, the problem is that we're now exploring order one scaled curvature terms. So cases where the physical curvature is greater than or order the cutoff scale that we're using. So here's the infrared cutoff, and that means that actually you're beginning to see the shape of the manifold, and it matters what the shape of the manifold is. You can hope that if you do everything right and you obey all the symmetries that are implied by this procedure, then it'll only depend upon the topology of the manifold, but it clearly depends upon at least the topology of the manifold. So how do you go? I've already hinted that we're going beyond polynomial truncations in order to see this. How do you do that? Well, I'm skipping a slide. First, other typical approximations. You've got another typical approximation is that you neglect the scale dependence, the ghosts and auxiliaries. That means that these guys only contribute through the inverse of their two-point vertices. And in particular, we can neglect the whole tower of states that you should have with the ghosts and auxiliaries contributing to higher dimension operators. Another typical approximation is to neglect mixed terms between the fluctuation field and the total metric, so-called single field approximation. Now, that's not always used, and these are exceptions shown here. And in particular, I'll have more to say about these two papers later. But it is, up until now, used exclusively when we go beyond polynomial truncations. So how do you do that? Well, for example, you can do, as I've already suggested, use a four-sphere background for the background metric. So non-negative, constant curvature. And project on this background so that the only terms that you're keeping in the effective action are a function of the background scalar curvature. So we're going to keep a general function, though, of this scalar curvature and, of course, renormalization group time. And if you crank the handle with that flow equation, what you end up with is a nonlinear partial differential equation for this function. Well, I'm going to concentrate on the fixed points of that and expansions around those fixed points, because of course that's all important for asymptotic safety. And the first authors to try this were here. And this is the equation they get. So there are little bit differences between the way that these equation is derived, and small differences in the equation, but essentially they're the same for both authors. I'm going to neglect the differences. So what you see in this equation, well, it's long and complicated for sure, but you also see these theta functions that come from the use of the optimized cutoff. You see that it's a third order ordinary differential equation, nonlinear. And you can see that there are some fixed singularities. So here's that 1 minus r over 3 pole that I mentioned before. This comes precisely from the so-called unphysical scalar mode. Well, you remember this power expansion that I showed before, this the sequence of polynomial truncations by these authors. They were exactly polynomial truncations of that equation. And of course, they don't see that pole because you're making a polynomial expansion. So how do you go beyond that? Well, here's a piece of textbook mathematics. If you've got a third order differential equation, you can write it in normal form, nonlinear. And let's suppose that you have a fixed singularity at r equals 0, which is just a simple pole. That means that this function up here, capital F, is a regular function of f in its first two derivatives and the scalar curvature. So if we're looking for a regular solution of this differential equation, even though it has this singular point here, so-called fixed singularity, we can see that that leads to a constraint on the parameters. And you can do that by substituting a Taylor expansion of this function f into this equation. So it's a third order differential equation, so we would expect to have three parameters around any local neighborhood, which we can take to be the first three Taylor expansion coefficients. But if you plug that into here, you see that in order for this to make sense, you need this piece to vanish, which means that you get some non-trivial constraint on the first three parameters through this function u here. So the lesson of this is that if you have a fixed singularity, your parameters get constrained to one dimension less in terms of the number of parameters you have, so from three to two parameters. So let's go back to our equation. We have a fixed singularity here. We actually have another one here, which comes from a very similar root. And then we have a couple which are multiplying this f triple prime term here. So that, all in all, is four fixed singularities on a three-dimensional parameter space, which means that these equations are overconstrained and actually don't have any global solutions. Well, progress was made by Benedetti and Caravelli in 2012 when they wrote down a differential equation which is much, much simpler. And they got there through essentially two devices. First of all, they were inspired by this paper, which introduced the ghosts and auxiliaries in such a way that cancellations that you would hope to see happen already automatically at the level of the flow equation. So that cleaned things up a lot. And then they worked hard to try and avoid as many fixed singularities in this differential equation as possible by choice of cutoff. And what they found was this equation here. So we still have two fixed singularities, one at r equals 0 coming from this guy, and one at approximately at this value coming from the root of this polynomial. So that would tell you, since it's again a third order differential equation, to expect a one parameter set of solutions. But the problem with these equations is they're nonlinear, and so you have also movable singularities. If you try and solve this equation at some point and integrate out, you'll find that typically what happens is that you stop at some point where the function hits a singularity generated by the nonlinear terms and it ceases to exist. What you can hope for is that if you choose your parameters very carefully, your boundary conditions, then it makes its way out to infinity, where you can again analyze it on paper.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Is there boundary condition for large value
of r? I'm just about to come to that, effectively. So, if it gets to large values of r, you can solve this equation. If you carefully, you can solve this equation in generality, And you can show that at large values of R, if it has no singularities in it, it has this asymptotic expansion with three parameters in it, capital A, B, and C. And this asymptotic expansion has no singularities in it to all orders, providing this cone condition is satisfied. So actually, what you find here, unlike in cases of old on more normal field theories, is that the large R dependence does not further constrain the dimension of the parameter space. It just has to satisfy this cone condition. So we really have a parameter space which is three parameters, but knocked down to one by these two fixed singularities. And that would tell us that we should expect a one-dimensional set of solutions, or in other words, physically lines of fixed points. Well, let me pause for just a second, because what we're doing here is we're considering the case where the scale curvature goes to infinity. And that's this picture, where the manifold has shrunk to a point on scales of the effective cutoff. Does that make sense? Should we even be considering the solution there? Well, I think so, because one way of looking at this, you're just dealing with ratios and scales, since this is renormalization group. One way of looking at this is that you have a manifold with fixed physical curvature, such as, say, the universe that we're living in at this moment, and you're letting k tend to zero. And remember, letting k tend to zero is the result of completing the functional integral. So I think that this would then give you a ratio which tends to infinity. So I think you do need to include this and require that the solution is regular. So very much like what we had in the case of global flows, which terminated prematurely here, unless you choose your cutoffs correctly. Well, we went ahead and searched for numerical solutions to those equations, and we indeed found lines of fixed points. Shown here are five lines of fixed points. There's probably many more. And they're plotted just here in terms of the first two coefficients of the Taylor expansion, just as a way of displaying them. And on the next transparency, I show you what the solutions look like corresponding to these three black dots. There's nothing particularly special about them, nothing particularly alarming. However, if you go through this parameter counting argument in terms of the eigenspectrum, then you do find something alarming. What I would say is, of course, we weren't expecting to get lines of fixed points. We were hoping to see maybe a unique asymptotically safe fixed point. So that's it seems that it's not as constraining as you would hope. The problem with the eigenspectrum is that the situation is the same. The eigenoperators are not discrete dimension eigenoperators. They're a continuous eigenspectrum with all possible dimensions. And that really is bad news. It means that if any of these fixed points actually support relevant directions corresponding to coupling constants, then they support a continuously infinite number of relevant directions corresponding to a continuously infinite number of coupling constants. So that's clearly hopeless. What can you do? Well, we speculated in this paper that one way you might get out of this is to consider this equation as holding over the whole of the real line, not just positive curvatures. And you see, if you're doing polynomial truncations, the truncations don't care whether you're dealing with positive or negative curvatures. So polynomial truncations automatically explore both sides of R equals zero. So maybe we should be doing so too. And the neat thing is, if you do that, is that you're encoding topology change. You see, you're requiring that you have a smooth, regular solution to this equation, which will take you smoothly from positive curvature, which is spheres, through zero curvature, which is flat space, into negative curvature, which is hyperboloids. And furthermore, if you do this, you find now that you have three fixed singular points, because you pick up a negative root from this polynomial. It's a third order differential equation with three fixed singularities, so you should expect a discrete set of fixed points. So that's nice. And furthermore, if you do the eigenoperator spectrum analysis, you find now that the eigenoperator spectrum is quantized. Well, you should expect to find so, which is nice. But then we looked numerically and we couldn't find any global solutions to this equation. But that was probably not unexpected. This, we were asking a bit too much of these equations. These equations were produced by working on four spheres and used various properties of four spheres. And what we should really do is we should generate some equations which are valid for hyperboloids for negative curvature, and then smoothly match between the positive curvature spheres to the negative curvature hyperboloids using the different equation. And actually, that's I mentioned this paper once already. That's essentially what these guys did in three dimensions in a conformal truncation of gravity. They derived the equations which were relevant for three-dimensional hyperboloids and for three-dimensional spheres, and then matched smoothly between them. However, they also found that you couldn't extend these solutions over the whole of the real line. Well, we realized there was another way of seeing what the problem was directly on four spheres, and I don't really have time to go through this argument, so I'm just going to give the punchline. It's actually quite straightforward. But the problem is that we found that the fixed points that we, these lines of fixed points, none of them actually support a vacuum solution. And at this level of approximation, that means that the whole entire eigenoperator spectrum is actually redundant. They're just reparametrizations of each other. The fixed points themselves are just reparametrizations of each other. So that gives some understanding of why there was this continuity in the eigenoperator spectrum and lines of fixed points. But it doesn't help. It means that this, this space of physical directions in this approximation scheme is empty. Well, what happened to this simple notion? We've gone a long way now. We've added a lot of technology, and we seem to have lost this simple notion. That motivated us to go back and have a look at these techniques in a much simpler setting, where we know the results we're expecting. So we looked at scalar field theory, just single component scalar field theory, in what's called the local potential approximation, where you keep a general potential here. Now, this is known from the past to be a very powerful approximation scheme. And in particular, if you work in three dimensions, for example, you'll see the Gaussian fixed point and the Wilson-Fischer fixed point corresponding to the Ising universality class. And you can derive scaling dimensions which are spot on for the Gaussian and a good approximation to the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. So what happens if we follow these techniques? So I'm going to do something crazy you wouldn't normally do with scalar field theory. I'm going to write the scalar field as a background field plus a fluctuation field. And then I'm going to introduce a cutoff, which is the optimized cutoff, which is going to have some background dependence through this term H, which I can choose. So that's something you wouldn't normally do with scalar field theory, but as I say, what we're trying to do is mock up in a simple model these techniques that are used in quantum gravity, asymptotic safety analysis. Well, if you do that, then you end up with this differential equation. And sure enough, when we started to analyze this for even apparently very sensible choices of H, you can get pathologies. You can make the Gaussian fixed point disappear. You can make the Wilson-Fischer fixed point disappear. You can get new fixed points which have the sort of pathologies I was just sketching, where they don't support a vacuum and entire sets of eigenoperators become redundant. So the lesson seems to be that the single field approximation needs looking at again. And you should keep both fields. If you do that, you end up in this simple model with a differential equation like this, which is even worse. And it's now a partial differential equation in the scale, the fluctuation field, and the background field. So it's a third, three-dimensional partial differential equation. But we do have a symmetry now that we can impose. So there's a Ward identity that tells you that actually the field you're dealing with is just the total field, which you split into two like this, which is just a shift on the background field and a negative shift on the fluctuation field. Well, we broke that by the way we introduced the cutoff, so we have a broken Ward identity. But nevertheless, that contains some crucial information. Now, this has been much treated and analyzed in the past. But we're going to give it very much center stage in this. And I'll talk about this paper later also that came out only last Friday. So if you do that, one thing you notice, which does seem to have perhaps been missed in the past, is that you need both the flow and this broken shift ward identity to determine a solution, also called a split symmetry, broken split symmetry. So see that, if we just look at this at the exact level, the flow equation takes this form. The flow equation has the effective action in it, but it appears only differentiated, either differentiated with respect to the scale k or differentiated with respect to the fluctuation field. That means that if you find a solution to this flow equation, you can add a term which is just a function of the background only, and it's still a solution because that will just disappear in these differentials. So the flow equation alone does not determine the solution. You need the shift ward identity as well together to determine a unique solution. So at the level of local potential approximation, these are the equations that we get. And then it turns out that if you consider this change of variables, these disgusting looking equations collapse to just this single equation, in which the background dependence has completely disappeared. So you see before your eyes background independence being implemented in this simple model. So this, of course, because there's no background dependence, this is exactly what you would have written down had you not played games and introduced a background field in the first place. And it gives you decent results of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point and Gaussian fixed point, as I mentioned earlier. So the lesson seems to be that we should be dealing with bimetric truncations, and we should be giving this split symmetry a much more central role. So I want to mention a couple of papers related to that. Let me come to this one first, where those points are made quite forcefully also. And this came out on Good Friday while I was still writing this talk, so I was able to update it. In this paper, which is going to be spoken about later in the week, they consider a double Einstein-Hilbert truncation where they keep both the fluctuation field and the background metric. And show that you can get fixed points which satisfy both the split symmetry and the requirements of asymptotic safety. And the other paper I want to highlight, which is in a sense related to these issues, is this one, Matter-Matters, which Astrid is going to be speaking about later on in the week, and where they keep wave function renormalization for the fluctuation field, background field, and all the other fields, namely loads of other matter fields. They keep all of those wave function renormalizations in an Einstein-Hilbert truncation to those flow equations. And what they find is that the asymptotic safety fixed point depends on the type of matter you put in, if you want to get a fixed point. Super, thank you. In particular, if you've got the standard model plus some reasonable extensions, you find you have got an asymptotic safety fixed point, but if you throw in tons of fields, such as the supersymmetric minimal standard model, or SU5 or SO10 guts, you find you don't have an asymptotic safety fixed point. So this is important even for model building and phenomenology studies. So those talks are this Friday, 9 and 9:40. And I also want to mention a really rather completely different approach that I haven't touched on by these authors, which is also going to get an airing in this workshop. Where you actually just keep you set the background metric to the flat space, and you just keep the fluctuation field, but you keep the full momentum dependence of those of the two-point vertex. So that's another very interesting approach, powerful approach. So to conclude, I seem to have rattled on at high speed. This is the fastest I managed, but here we go. We've seen there's a huge body of work showing that asymptotic safety in various truncations and approximations. And you always see this this behavior that you have three relevant directions, asymptotically safe fixed point. However, as I've sought to emphasize, it's important to go beyond polynomial truncations to explore order one scaled curvature effects. And when you do so, new effects become visible, and the equations themselves become much more sensitive to issues to do with the approximations that you're doing and the symmetries involved. And it's clear to me, I think, that more work is needed still to disentangle cutoff pathologies from the physics and to work with less drastic approximations at this level, in particular the bimetric truncations. And finally, there are some further talks on asymptotic safety in directions that I haven't touched on by these authors in this workshop. So that's it. Thank you.
Questions.
That's the best way, isn't it?
You
basically you end up with this continuous line of fixed points. Well, in the past we had examples of that. For instance, this relevant direction by Wang and Halpern around the Gaussian fixed point for the scalar theory.
Uh-huh. So, oh, yes, the Halpern Huang, I know them well. I don't believe a word of it.
But that's an issue. Maybe there is a lesson that we should learn, not, and we should not insist that the universality class of this theory is like the universality class of the Ising. So I think that there is a possibility, and if we insist that we have to think that at the very end that should behave like the easy model, that's a mistake. So we should be more open-minded.
Sure. So it would have been lovely to have, I agree entirely with that thesis. This quantum gravity research, all quantum gravity research, you're searching in the dark, right? Because you don't know what you're aiming for. You can't compare it to experiment. So you've got to let the maths be your guide. And if those continuous solutions had behavior that I could have lived with, I'd have been happy. But the thing that really you can't live with is the fact that you get this continuous set, you get this continuous spectrum. If that's for real and all of those continuous spectrum are correct, then you actually have a continuously infinite set of coupling constants. So it's actually worse than just using a perturbative quantum gravity around the Gaussian fixed point. It could be, yes. You'd have to believe it if that keeps being repeated.
That would be, this Halpern Huang would be an example. You don't believe that would be an example of a model which can work in that way.
The other thing that I should say is also, as we saw, we could see that eigen operator spectrum is actually redundant. They're just reparameterizations of each other. As to the Halpern Huang paper,
So if I understood properly, it seems in the two equations you presented, the type of singularity you get seems to depend heavily on the choice of cutoff and the truncation of the goal. So how, in this whole business, how do you, it's about your fourth line here. How can you be sure that what you're doing is not just cutoff dependence?
I think that's an important. Well, so, actually, even simple, this isn't actually just a problem for quantum gravity. It's a general problem in the renormalization group that you don't often meet, but it's there. So let me give you a simple example. If you just do the Ising model in terms of block spins, then it's known that decimation, which is the idea that when you do the block spin, you just pick at random one of the microscopic spins and say that's your macroscopic spin. That's known to be to have all sorts of pathologies. So it's possible, and more generally, it's possible in quite normal field theories to generate pathologies if you're not careful with your choice of cutoff. What you should see is that there should be a whole range of cutoffs that you can choose, where the results are, if you can do things exactly, completely independent of those cutoffs. That's your universality, but there are boundaries to that universality set. That's the point I'm making. And in practice, however, because you're making approximations, you hope for some approximate independence of the choice of cutoff. So yeah, it's a bit of a minefield, but it's definitely a place that needs looking at. Another thing that I would say is that my gut feeling is that there's too much flexibility in the choice of cutoffs at the moment. You can choose different cutoffs for the ghosts, and you do for the fluctuation method. That's not right, or at least if it is right, then BRS invariance, which has been rather neglected in this approach up until now, should be telling you whether that's valid and what types of cutoffs you should use. So there are symmetries in the theory which will help tell you what you should be doing, I suspect. Martin?
I think about removing the line of inference by background independence, if we know that this happens in conformity with Lewis gravity, that is what we think with Holger Weyer, there is this mean of phi toy model, if you wish, of f of r gravity, and for conformity with this potential for the conformal factor, you can show that the imposing background independence, the possibility of various kinds of nonsensical, let's put it that way, nonsensical eigenvalue problems determining the number of relevant nodes, will disappear when you impose background independence. In particular, you can turn a finite dimensional critical hypothesis, or you can obtain a finite dimensional one from the infinite.
I think that the only one is the Einstein impact. I think it's the only solution that you got. In that, no other non-polynomial things.
Yes, I do know your paper, Martin. Thank you. I'm remiss in not mentioning that. Apologize.
Yeah. I've read about the possibility of the existence of an infrared fixed point, and I would like to ask, what is the status of this, and what could be the meaning?
Yeah, so the infrared fixed point within quantum gravity. I don't know. But there'll be experts in the audience who do. Is that Daniel?
Well, I mean, there are a few studies looking into this, or have looked into this. I mean, there is well-known neuralgical point which has been noticed early on. And what has become clearer now is that this neuralgic point at vanishing dimension is Newton coupling, and some positive value for the dimensionless cosmological constant, right, is due to kind of degeneracy in several fixed points sitting on top of each other. And it so turns out that, so this degeneracy you can actually already see from the simplest Einstein-Hilbert equations, which Tim has discussed. Yes. Now, in order to make them explicit, is you need to shake the system a bit and give it a bit more dynamics and structure to allow the system for developing both of these independent fixed points. Yes. And one way for doing it is to, for example, evaluate RG flows, okay, as we normally do in space quantum field theory on flat backgrounds. And first studies have actually in explicit computations now shown that this system develops two types of infrared fixed points, one which is non-trivial in both of these couplings I mentioned, and another one which becomes classical, okay, where say the G Newton becomes classical, but you may end up with some non-trivial positive cosmological. Most of these scenarios look reasonable, say.
Both fixed points are classical, actually.
It is a high temperature fixed point.
Sorry?
It is a high temperature fixed point, what you're talking about.
It's an infrared fixed point.
It's a high temperature, I don't know if like high temperature or not. What's the correlation length?
It's a classical fixed point. So
yeah, what's the correlation length of this fixed point?
It's a Gaussian fixed point. The couplings go to zero. It's classical.
Yeah, but if don't you tell me what's the correlation length. I mean, yeah. In high temperature fixed point is a completely stupid fixed point, you know?
I think the conversation should go around. I mean, the high temperature fixed point would require a mass term, and I suspect there aren't any mass terms.
Let's go to the next question for a moment.
Can you explain again the example you had with the scalar field? So it seemed like you were looking at some low temperature phase with a non-zero expectation value of the field.
Not
this phi, instead of putting zero.
You're referring to this?
You have a zero phi bar in this background field method now?
Yeah.
So what is the... So you can analyze this system using the standard normalization group, but what is the, the ambiguity that you're pointing out here?
So that whole ambiguity comes from this single field approximation. So the single field approximation, actually, I went over that a little bit fast. The single field approximation amounts to identifying the background field dependence with the total field. And so you end up with this approximate equation. So the points I was making were related to this approximate equation. If you don't make approximations, then you get sensible results. But that's this bottom line here.
This is a statement about the vector reach approach to the renormalization of the theory.
Not really, no. It's not. No. It's not that global. It's about this single field approximation where you throw away the fact that you really got two fields in here. Well, it's true that Christoph Betterick has used that a lot, but so have lots of other people. So it's really a statement about that approximation scheme and not making that approximation scheme. So I just want to come back to Martin Reuter's point, because I do realize I should have said that Martin Reuter and Manrik have emphasized this point about keeping the split symmetry several times in the past. Very much inspired our work.
I have two comments, actually. One is concerning the infrared fixed points. I mean, the state of the art is now, and I will talk about this. There is a de Sitter and an anti de Sitter classical fixed point. This also tells you, because then you have an Einstein-Hilbert action, what the correlation length is. Okay? It's very difficult anyway to talk about correlation length in gravity. So it's nothing about a finite temperature fixed point. So these are classical fixed points. This is by now clear. The second thing is about the split symmetry. I mean, there's a longer history to it, actually. So early on, 2002, Daniel and I showed that if you go to Young-Mills theory, you can even alter, if you make the background approximation, you can alter the one-loop beta function, which is universal. And this is exactly coming from a term which is only dependent on the background field.
And that's then this, right, yes.
The split
yes,
symmetry right. also has been used in the geometrical approach, where actually split symmetry is, I think, a bad word, because what it is really is the Nielsen identity. And there's an additional term in gauge theories, which is not there in a scalar theory. In a scalar theory, what you have is you remove the cutoff, and you get a theory which only depends on the sum of the two fields. Whereas in the gauge theory, this is not so.
No, that's
absolutely
right.
This point has been made in the literature several times. Actually, if you do such an approximation in Young-Mills theory, you lose confinement. So there are several papers, concerning gravity, starting in 2011, a paper.
That's why your names are here. Sorry, there was such a lot of papers actually dealing with this.
That's Daniel Litterman, myself, but this is really spelled out. It's not split symmetry. I'm sorry, this is very important, I think. So.
No, but
it's a Nielsen identity, and even without cutoff, there are terms which break this symmetry in terms of that you have a sum of the fields. It's very important.
Yeah, okay, well, I look forward to talking to you about that. But it's certainly the case that if you embed this into gravity, it's far less obvious that's going to help, but it does.
Oh, it does.
Hmm. Yes, I know.
I mean, maybe just to make it very precise, whenever we write 5 plus 5 bar, we don't mean 5 plus 5 bar, but we mean the first two terms or just the beginning of the exponential. That's not to be taken too literally.
Okay, so then let me another.